Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I look at my friend Helen, who is the baby of our class, and she looks to me. I am 3 months older. It's my house we're on our way to, so I take stock. A huge sow is distractedly shunting back and forth between the hedgerows, squealing and snouting the tarmac. Her teats swing low to the ground, eye wideningly obvious and full and shockingly human-like. We are all six-year-old instinct and inexperience, stopped dead in our tracks, unsure how to get past her. Not a sinner in sight. Between the hedge-topped ditches stretches half a mile of road yet to my house. We could try to climb up the ditch and through the wire into Bradley's field, pass her out that way, but Helen's arm is still in the sling from when she came off the roller skates. I've been warned to be careful. We could just wait for a tractor to come along, but the noise might send the sow over the edge entirely, with us savaged to death before the driver could intervene. Or our plight might remain entirely beneath his notice, often the case with adults. And the disturbance might only serve to chivvy her on a bit, and what good's that? Vehicle after vehicle, shunting her a few yards farther on each time, us trotting after. It is 1966, traffic is sparse. We could be here all day, playing wary tig with a pig. The hill we've just skipped down to have our gallop halted by this maddened sow is at our backs. Now we hear big boys, half a dozen 9-10-year-olds noisily cresting it. Aged 6, I've learned not to expect gallantry from boys, but these may be of use as a buffer. I plan to let them go past. We'll just tuck in behind unnoticed, keep them between us and the sow. It doesn't occur to me that we will be of any interest to them. They thunder, whooping down the hill towards and around us. A gander-necked boy demands, "What are yous?" Helen ducks in behind me. I can feel her dependent grip on my cardigan. We're instinctively on guard, but we don't know against what. We girls? Is too obvious an answer. So what's the meaning? And why the menace in this unexpectedly conceptual question? Age 6 in the 1960s, life is binary. I only know what I am not. Boy is the gold standard and we are obviously not boy. So, are yous Catholics? Lifeline. Something I recognise, because I know the Gormleys are Catholics. I sit in their hall stairs of an evening while Anne and Martin say their prayers in the kitchen. Then Grania brings me back in for orange squash before they have to go to bed and I have to run home across the field. Daddy says it's about where you go of a Sunday. People go different places. Some of my aunties are Methodists. I don't say any of this out loud. The chosen subject is puzzling, but that's boys for you. At least I now recognise the topic. Here goes. I'm Church of Ireland and she's Presbyterian. A sudden violence of twigs and grit skirls around our flinching heads as sticks indignantly thwack the hedgerow, clods are kicked out of the ditch and across the road, and inarticulate boy noise is interspersed with accusations that make no sense. There is nothing orange on either of us. What kind of sin is proddy sin? I've never heard tell of it. Helen's crying. We are now backed up the ditch and against the barbed wire. I don't remember doing that. I hear somebody shout, "Stop it! Her arm is in plaster from Paris." It's me. I am out of body and have moved up in the big boy's face, the epitome of moral outrage with nettle stings on my legs. The big boys suddenly drop us and move on to torment the sow, our nemesis and saviour both. Billy Anderson's being the only piggery around, the sow, by association, would not have been the big boy's co-communicant either. What are you? she would have had as much cognizance of the nuance of that as Helen and I did, age six, in 1966. It wasn't long before a much bigger crowd trod that exact stretch of road where we met the pig. I watched them march right past my house, up Glen Shane towards Burntollet Bridge, where they met a mob who felt no need to ask any questions at all of either the marchers or, it seems, themselves. By contrast, Helen and I were permitted to scramble off without further molestation across the fields, over bog cotton, shuch and brambles to my house, where we had our uneventful tea.
In Monkstown, along the shores of Dublin Bay, there is a loose grouping of plaques commemorating the homes of astronomers. I was somewhat familiar with two of the astronomers even before seeing the plaques. William Parsons, 3rd Earl of Ross, famous for his Birr Castle Leviathan telescope, lived near Belgrave Square in the years before his death in 1867. Not far away, on Longford Terrace, with spectacular views of the bay, is one of the former homes of eminent telescope maker Howard Grubb. Then, just 50 metres away, is a third plaque, which reads, Lady Margaret Huggins, née Murray, 1848-1915, astronomer, lived here 1856-1875. And that's the problem with plaques celebrating the great and the good. There is so little space for information, they are often not particularly illuminating. And if you don't know much about the person, these plaques can be of limited help. But I've usually found their subjects reward further investigation, and that was certainly the case with Lady Margaret Huggins, née Murray. Margaret was born in Dublin of Scottish parents at 62 Lower Gardiner Street, once an elegant residence, now a backpacker hostel. Her mother died when she was 8 or 9 years of age, and when her father remarried, Margaret, apparently sidelined in the new relationship, went to live with her grandfather at the Monkstown Terrace. Margaret was partly educated at home and partly at a Brighton boarding school, but it was her home education that would prove most useful. Her grandfather introduced her to what would become her life's work, the study of the heavens. As a young girl, Margaret learned about the stars, even studying sunspots using an instrument she made. She was also a keen photographer, a pursuit deemed suitable for ladies of the time. When she was around 17, what would turn out to be a particularly formative moment in her life came when she read an article by amateur astronomer William Huggins. At the time, Huggins was doing groundbreaking work in the new field of stellar spectroscopy. He split light emanating from stars through a series of prisms into what, to the modern eye, looked like elongated barcodes. William drew and then studied these lines. By using this method, he was able to prove that the Sun was made of the same material as stars, that the Sun was, in fact, a star. In 1870, William came to Dublin to collect a new telescope from Howard Grubb of Longford Terrace, Margaret's near neighbour. It's believed that on this visit, Grubb first introduced the young woman to the man she so admired. Though the nature of their initial friendship is not documented, it soon turned into a courtship. In 1875, Margaret, aged 27, married the 51-year-old William in Monkstown Church. Photos of Margaret show her as a striking-looking woman with inquisitive eyes and dark hair with shocks of grey. The two lived at Tulse Hill, South London, where they spent the rest of their lives. Margaret was often depicted as supporting her husband, tidying up, setting up instruments, mixing chemicals. However, Margaret was much more than that. She became integral to her husband's work. She recorded their observations and brought her particular skills to bear. Instead of drawing the barcode lines, she photographed them and developed the images using new techniques. This made for a much more accurate analysis of the constituents of starlight and put her and William at the forefront of the field of spectroscopic astrophotography. Margaret and William were very much partners making new discoveries, in particular about the Orion Nebula. Despite the social mores of the time and Margaret's reticence to share her husband's limelight, she was not entirely overlooked. In 1889, their first jointly authored paper was published. In 1897, when William was knighted by Queen Victoria on her Golden Jubilee, Margaret was the only woman acknowledged on the list, though she was not actually named. According to the citation, William was knighted for the great contribution which, with the collaboration of his gifted wife, he had made to the new science of astrophysics. For some years, the couple were at the cutting edge of astronomy. But, as time passed, the field began to be taken over by universities and institutions, and the two became relics of the era of the amateur astronomer. William died in 1910, and then Margaret in 1915. In her will, Margaret asked that a memorial to her husband be erected in the crypt of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Though true to form, Margaret's image, though included, is a small cameo below the prominent one of her husband. When I first came across the plaque to Margaret, I thought it was a pity that more of her story could not have been told. But now I think the brevity, the simplicity of the text is a most fitting tribute to this remarkable person. Lady Margaret Huggins, née Murray, astronomer.
There is a sort of rumour, perhaps it's more of an urban legend, which many within the acting community believe to be true and cling to like a sacred text. If the number of actors in a play, the story goes, outnumbers the audience waiting to watch it, the show can be cancelled and those performers shall have the afternoon off. No one seems to know exactly when this understanding became theatrical law, but most will agree it was sometime between the death of Aeschylus and the debut performance of John Gielgud. In reality, no such agreement exists, and though the theatre management may offer a particularly sparse audience tickets for another day, in buying a seat a contract has been entered into, and the purchaser can demand that the service he has paid for is delivered. The truth of the situation was driven home to me in the early 1980s, when a couple of friends and I decided that what the Edinburgh International Festival really needed was a production of Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialist crowd-pleaser, No Exit. Such was the level of our enthusiasm that even the discovery that we would be performing our piece at 9:30 in the morning, in a school hall barely within the Edinburgh postal district, could do nothing to dampen it. No Exit has a cast of three, and is most famous for the line spoken by the middle-aged journalist Joseph Garcin. Hell, he says, is other people. Ironically, of course, with our production, other people were the one thing you didn't really have to worry about. There were, after all, very few of them. 35 years ahead of its time, the production was like a masterclass in social distancing. Sometimes we played to an audience of four, sometimes seven. Once there were 13. And then, on the final Monday morning of the run, there was one. His name, I was later to discover, was Clive. We were backstage adjusting our makeup or fixing our costumes or doing one of those other mysterious things that actors do backstage, when our company manager, Laura, came to tell us of Clive's solitary status. There was a brief discussion regarding the possibility of cancelling the show, and then one of the company spoke up. I hate to admit it, but I'm afraid the voice raised was mine. Where, I demanded, was our spirit? Where was our ambition, our dedication? What about our art, our hunger to perform? What about the agreement we had made, albeit unspoken, with Mr. Sartre? This audience member, I continued, had got up early and paid his money. He had at the very least given up his morning to see us, and surely by the lowest measure of professional pride, we owed him a show. And so we went on. And we gave Clive a show. We gave Clive our no exit. And when it was over, he clapped politely. We left the stage. And then Clive stayed exactly where he was. As we changed out of our costumes, we wondered to one another why he hadn't left. Was he a critic, hoping to talk to the performers for an article he was writing? Was he perhaps an agent, keen to represent one or more of us? Was he possibly a relative of Jean-Paul Sartre, who had come equipped with a cease and desist order to prevent our show from inflicting further damage on their great uncle's reputation? I decided to find out what he was up to, and as I went back onto the stage to clear our props away, I engaged him in polite conversation. It was here that I learnt his name, and that he had driven up from Manchester, a journey that had begun at 4 o'clock in the morning. And why, I casually continued, had he decided to come and see our play? It was surely not the performers, but was it perhaps a love of the author, or of French literature in general? No, Clive laughed. I'm not really a fan of... He was searching for the right word, and I wondered what it might be. What wasn't he a fan of? The French? The 1940s? Getting up at 4 in the morning? Unsure which one to go for, Clive eventually gave up, and opted instead for... I thought the acting was very good. And then suddenly he stopped, and he looked a little embarrassed. He had come, he told me, because his sister was performing in a production of Miss Julie, which was playing in the same venue directly after us. He checked his watch. In 45 minutes, to be precise, he offered helpfully. He had simply come into the theatre early, because he had parked outside and couldn't afford to keep the heater running in his car. Perhaps Monsieur Sartre is right. Perhaps hell is other people. Without doubt, however, disillusionment is learning why other people go to the theatre.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie, et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi.
Life is normal, long pre-COVID. I'm out for the evening with a friend I haven't seen in ages. I like the bag, she says the minute we meet. Oh, thanks, I reply, trying to sound casual, but probably smiling quite smugly, because this new acquisition is on its maiden outing and a compliment is coming its way already. I ease it from my shoulder. Amazing, Eleanor says, and now I see more disbelief than admiration on her face. That bag was mine. She launches into the biography of the black patent masterpiece on the table between us. She bought it in a Brown Thomas sale and gave it a good lash, as she puts it, for 3 or 4 years before donating it to a charity fundraising event. The person who bought it, a handbag-obsessed friend of Eleanor's with hundreds of trophies already, later told her she'd had second thoughts and consigned it to a resale outlet in town. Ah, I say, rumbled. That's where I found it. I don't mention that I visited it there 3 times, stroking it like a pet and strutting around with it draped across my body before cutting a fairly painful deal. I didn't even notice the scuff mark on one handle, which confirmed to Eleanor that it had been hers. I'm not a serious bag person. I don't have many because the effort of moving the contents from one to another is too much hassle. And although I love good leather, I don't care about labels and logos. Even if I were filthy rich, I can't imagine shelling out the price of a round-the-world trip on a Birkin bag from Hermès, for instance. A basic Birkin, I mean. Nothing as exclusive as the white Himalaya crocodile version auctioned by Christie's in 2017 for close to $400,000. I couldn't even countenance a couple of grand for one of those quilted Chanel jobs with a shoulder chain. Apart from the wild extravagance, it would be too fancy and way too small. My bags are big. Smaller would be smarter, not just in terms of looks, but also, apparently, in terms of what it says about your brain power, according to an alarming article on the internet. The owners of small bags are more focused and intelligent, it claims, than the messy individuals who reach for volume. Well, good for them, but I can't see how they manage. I've no idea how those little drawstring reticules became such a hit in Jane Austen's day either. Alongside the usual essentials, wallet, phone, lipstick, handkerchief, keys, pens, and now a mask and hand sanitizer too, I need to fit in a bottle of water, because I'm always thirsty, and a cardigan, because I'm often shivery, and sometimes an umbrella, and maybe the occasional bottle of wine, purely for research, you understand. A book is often slipped in as well, although lockdown's most rewarding reading didn't qualify. Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light, 875 pages and 1.3 kilos, was even more firmly confined to barracks than I was. Like half the population, I cleared out my wardrobe, ruthlessly, having watched too many YouTube videos by Audrey Coyne, an advocate of fashion minimalism. Clothes and shoes were culled for a second life with a new owner, which should be starting around now. But my bags survived the purge and were rewarded for long service with more space on the shelf. Sometimes I imagine them gossiping to each other, mostly about me. Ah, her horizons have definitely shrunk, says a capacious old in-flight favourite. She used to travel the world, you know. I went everywhere with her. Australia, Argentina, India, Africa, the Arctic Circle, all over the States, all around Europe. But these days, I'll be lucky to get to Belfast on the train. I must be nearly as old as you, says a boxy number. Her daughter persuaded her to buy me in Filene's bargain basement in Boston years ago. She took me to a good few dinner parties, but apparently nobody has those anymore. The daughter borrowed me once, though. Oh, the daughter has borrowed me loads of times, boasts a grandiose suede and calfskin clutch. She loves me. The mother bought me for that girl's wedding. I still get out occasionally, but only when she dresses up, and that hasn't happened in months. No, and it must be years since she added to our small number, laments a burgundy tote. You'd imagine she might have fallen for a newcomer by now. I'm listening to them, whispering away. 1,000 steps from my front door, so handy for the illusion that healthy daily walks are being maintained, our neighbourhood vintage shop has reopened. It has probably never been so densely populated with gorgeous bags. I might drop in.
Ever seen a blind man cross the road? trying to make the other side.
One pleasant August afternoon, I was sitting at the window of our flat, putting the finishing touches to a small patchwork quilt. The top of the quilt was made from scraps of Laura Ashley fabric, and to line it, I had cut up a summer dress that I felt I would never fit into again. It was 1979, and I was the happiest girl in the world. We had been married for almost 3 months, and I had been pregnant for 6. This could have been a problem, but a hastily arranged wedding had rectified it, and I couldn't help but admire the gold ring on my finger that had endowed respectability on our situation. We were renting a nice flat in Phibsborough that cost us £25 a week, almost a third of our combined income. I was teaching in a private school, and although I hadn't actually signed a contract, I had been told I would be teaching the same group of children again in September. My salary was half of what I would have been paid in a state school, but we had enough to live on and were even managing to save a deposit for a small cottage on the North Strand. Married life was very agreeable. I was still on my school holidays, and once my husband went to work in the morning, the whole day was mine. My pregnancy was blissful, and I spent the long summer days going for walks, reading, and making clothes for our baby. So I was stitching away happily, glancing up every now and again at the selection of tiny garments in the new Moses basket, the little matinee coats I had knit in soft white or yellow baby yarn, jazzy cardigans crocheted from scraps of navy, red and yellow wool, when, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a car draw up outside and the school's headmistress get out. My heart did an almighty lurch and the baby kicked in protest. There was no reason for the headmistress to visit me. A sense of regret that I had written to her the previous week to apply for maternity leave in December began to creep over me. I sat there paralysed and watched this middle-aged lady, elegant in a white linen dress, negotiate the troublesome gate and walk up the path to the front door, car keys dangling on her left hand, right hand moving towards the bell. There was only one thing to do. When the bell rang, I dropped on all fours and crept behind an armchair. Cowering there, I prayed that the woman in the flat upstairs was out. She wasn't. Sweat ran down my back as I listened to her footsteps on the stairs, the front door being opened, and the headmistress asking if Anne lived here. When the knock came to the door, I decided to surrender, and legs quivering, I got myself up and waddled out, yawning, trying to feign surprise. I managed to greet her politely and invited her into our little sitting room where she sat down. I made some excuses about the state of the place as I cleared the scraps of fabric, needles and thread off the other chair, but she didn't seem to notice my little bundle of baby clothes in the basket. She had to tell me, she said, that it would be better if I did not come back to school. I think she said it kindly, emphasising how unfair it would be on my pupils to be changing teachers in their final year, and how it would be equally unfair on me if I had to make the long commute to the school in my condition. My face was stretched into a stiff mask, as every atom in my body and soul fought to maintain some dignity. Now that I had been, in effect, sacked, I wanted her to leave. But she stayed there watching me. Was she afraid I would burst into tears or suddenly go into labour? I held myself together as I mentally calculated the collateral damage. I knew I hadn't accumulated enough stamps to apply for maternity benefit, and with no job and my career now in tatters, our plans to buy the little cottage were fading. The future did not look good. Maybe she read my mind, because as she stood up to leave, she said that she might be able to find a little job for me around the school, helping out in the office or something, for half the salary. I wanted to accept, but my tongue seemed to be frozen. And then she was gone, leaving a subtle waft of expensive perfume in her wake. I stumbled into bed, pulled the blanket over my face and stayed there, wondering how I would tell my husband that half our income had just disappeared. I never knew how my absence was explained to the staff or to the class of 12-year-old girls who were waiting for me the following week, because I never saw any of them again. I never saw the headmistress again either. I never got to tell her that everything had been all right for us after all, that our baby's arrival at Christmas had brought us unimaginable joy, the kind of joy that put that August afternoon in the shade and made our future shine again. And I came to realise that when you have youth, health and love on your side, everything is possible.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.